Senator Reiner, I don't think our
sounds okay. Better.
Oh, we didn't have our volume up. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I'm just going to do a brief introduction, then I'll turn over to testifiers. Members, what this bill does is try to capture. We all know that when we have a landline, we pay a 911 fee. We as consumers pay that to help support the 911 emergency response system. Where we have a gap in that is in prepaid cards, calling cards, as well as kind of the secondary market of cell systems. So we have some aspects, and members, you probably know either personally or anecdotally, that's one of the faster-growing markets of the cell network. And what we have going on right now that this bill tries to address is gaps in that system where the fee is not being collected at all, either by people that are buying their cell service on a card or buying it from one of the secondary companies who just rent space off the major networks systems. We also have some of the major carriers that are taking that fee out of the cards and the service when they sell it. We have some that are taking it out of their own overhead. We have some that aren't doing it at all. So we have a lack of consistency across the board. So this bill is meant to address that. It's meant to get revenue back into the 911 system where it belongs. So we've got some testifiers that will talk about that. Members, I will give you a heads up that we're working, especially with the grocers. You know, these prepaid cards especially are sold at a lot of small stores. Well, they're sold at a lot of retail locations, everything from major retailers down to mom-and-pop shops that are on the corner in our small towns around Minnesota. We're actively in negotiations. We had a meeting just earlier today for a half hour to talk about what the right percentage for them to withhold of a sale of the 911 fee is to account for their handling that and processing it. And the Department of Revenue is also, that's who we're asking to collect this money, account for it, and get it back out. So there's a withhold for them as well. We haven't, I think, found the sweet spot yet on that, but I think we're moving in a positive direction. So, Mr. Chair, with that and your permission, I will invite testifiers to speak.
Thank you, Senator Reinert. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
I do have a handout, Mr. Chair.
My name is Dan Leary. I'm the Principal Manager of Government Affairs at T-Mobile. I'm based in Chicago. I handle a number of states and worked on this issue for the last several years. The Senator did a good job of explaining the problem. About 4 years ago, the industry... Oh, and I should say I also provided some testimony. I think you have it, but I'm not going to read it. The industry got together, the wireless industry, retailers, the public safety community, and legislators at NCSL, among other places, and we came up with a model bill, in which the bill you have in front of you is relatively close to that model bill. It has morphed a little bit over the years. Some things work better than other things that we had initially tried. But we feel that what we have here is a fair method to capture these funds that have been going uncaptured. It'll provide a steady stream of revenue for the public safety community, and it will be fair. Currently, prepaid customers in some cases aren't paying a 911 fee at all, and postpaid customers are essentially subsidizing that and landline companies. So with that, I'll take questions.
Thank you. Questions, members?
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Reiner.
I would just point out, members, the handout I gave you, there are 26 states that currently already do this, and so it gives you the sticking point right now is on this, what does the retailer keep, what does the Department of Revenue keep? So you have an idea of what all the other states are doing that have adopted this. And I just want to point out that the bill is modeled on proposed language from NCSL.
Thank you. Quorum is present. Mr. Murphy.
No. I'm just here for my general good looks, Mr. Chair. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
The table looks very nice. Both ends. All right, members, questions? Senator Reinert or the handsome Mr. Murphy. One thing. The one thing I remember, pardon me if I was dealing with some traffic up here earlier, so I wasn't listening with both ears. One thing we discussed in my office when you first brought this bill to my attention was the mechanism by which the fee is withheld from these calling cards, and it's deducted on a regular basis from folks who hold the cards. Is that because the way the language is written in law now, and conceivably someone could hold on to a card for quite a while, lose value on a regular basis, ultimately use up the entire value of that card, quite possibly, and be left with a card that has no value unbeknownst to them. Can you explain that a little bit? That's what I find most compelling about this proposal.
Mr. Chairman, Tom Murphy again, representing AT&T, and that's appropriate that I represent AT&T because that is the mechanism by which we recover the 911 fee from the customer. And the statute requires the carriers to collect the 911 fee from the customer. And that's how we do it on your postpaid cell phone bill that you receive in the mail and your landline bill. The customer, if you have a landline, which a growing number do not, but if you have a cell phone, you also pay that fee to 911, to AT&T in this case, and we remit that to the Department of Public Safety. With a prepaid calling card, and that's where the sticky wicket is here, we don't know who the customer is. So we're trying to identify who the customer is in this case. What AT&T does as a practice to recover the fee from the customer per the statute is to decrement the 81 cents of minutes off your calling card. So is the example that Senator Dibble just cited, you buy a 500-minute calling card, and I know for a fact there's two people in this room who do precisely what I'm about to describe. They buy a 500-minute calling card or whatever amount it may be, and every month, again, per the statute, we decrement 81 cents from that card. And believe me, customers do not like the fact when they get to the point of using their card, because we'll do that every month, again, per the statute, where all the minutes have been used up from the card. And we believe we're just following the statute, and customers do not like that method of recovering the fee.
If I might add, Mr. Chairman, not all the carriers do it that way, and that's part of the problem. T-Mobile, my company, and Sprint, we simply write the state a check. And some other carriers interpret the statute that it doesn't apply at all to prepaid customers, and therefore they're not sending a check to the state, and thus the state isn't collecting any money. So part of the problem is the statute just isn't clear.
Thank you. Senator Ryan.
And, Mr. Chair, conversely, some retailers have actually tried to submit to the state what they think their portion of this is, only to have the state send it back because the statute's not clear. So.
Sounds like we got a mess. Any further questions, Senator Franzen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Reinert, you just mentioned retailers. Do they have a position on this particular way of funding 911?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinert.
The retailers are neutral on the bill. It's honest to say that the grocers have some concern about the withhold, feeling that especially for their smaller establishments, they would like to see it bigger at the start because they're adding some new complexity to the system of the corner grocery store. The active negotiation we're in is you get 3% ongoing, even after that initial startup cost has been taken care of. So, as I said when I started, we're actively working on that component.
And Senator Franzen, we're going to hear from the grocers next, unless there are further questions for our current witnesses. All right, I have Jamie Fool from Minnesota Grocers Association.
Mr. Chair, I don't think they're here. I'm happy to read the letter.
That's fine. Members, you have a statement from the grocers in some of their.
I think I've honestly reflected what I think their primary concern is.
So that's on this sheet, if members
yes,
want to.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Did I hear a request? All right. Anything further, members? Senator Reinert, do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would ask the committee to.
Senator Reinert, I'm trying to remember to call for further testimony before I call for the vote on the bill. Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Reiner.
Mr. Chair, I would ask that the committee move the bill forward with recommendation, and I think our next stop is taxes.
Any questions on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Thank you. Very efficient. I like that. Next we have, what should we jump? Senator Metzen, ready for Senate File 679. Oh, there he is. Greetings. Welcome, Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This bill is brought to me from the manufacturers and retailers of automobiles in Minnesota. What it does, it makes a clear distinction that manufacturers aren't in the car selling business. They are in the manufacturing business, and that the retailers are the ones that that sell the cars. It deals with Chapter 80E, regulates the contractual relationship between Minnesota motor vehicle dealers and vehicle manufacturers. State law is necessary to ensure fairness in these contracts because of the enormous disparity in bargaining power between the franchisee and the global automakers. So I understand that this kind of really clarifies things, and it's been worked out with the manufacturers and the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, and I'm sure most of you have, or a lot of you have dealerships in your areas, and but they want this to be passed, and it just ensures that they're sold in an appropriate manner. And this, like I say, has been worked out with the entities that are involved. I have a couple of the Meta auto dealer representatives here. Maybe they want to say a couple of words, or did you want to state your name?
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jacob Milner, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. The Minnesota Auto Dealers Association is a trade association representing the interests of all Minnesota new vehicle dealers. We represent 100% of the new car dealers in the state of Minnesota, and all of our members are licensed and support the very reasonable and necessary requirements of the state of Minnesota's new vehicle dealership license laws. The state of Minnesota has a long-established system for distributing new motor vehicles through dealers who are who have franchise agreements with auto manufacturers. Since the purchase of a motor vehicle is one of the most expensive and one of the most regulated products anywhere in the marketplace, it makes good sense that the state has sought fit to impose numerous requirements on motor vehicle sellers for the benefit of consumers and to prevent any one manufacturer from creating a monopoly. Our state law creates a clear division of the business rights and responsibilities between new vehicle dealers on the one hand and auto vehicle manufacturers on the other. To become a licensed new car dealer in the state of Minnesota, you must have a franchise agreement with an auto manufacturer. These agreements require a new car dealer to provide, at virtually no cost to the manufacturer, I might add, a facility that meets the requirements of that manufacturer. These independent dealerships, which are Minnesota small business owners, they own the property, the building, pay the payroll, the taxes, buy the inventory from the manufacturer. In essence, this is virtually a cost-free distribution system for the manufacturer. Additional requirements of being a licensed new car dealer is that you must operate at your licensed location in a commercial building where records and purchase agreements, tax receipts, title transfer documents are all stored and readily accessible by authorities during normal business hours. Under our law, your license to operate a motor vehicle dealership will be suspended for violating the motor vehicle title laws, sales tax, consumer protection statutes. Failure to pay taxes and file reports required by the states are also considered a violation. A repair facility is also required by our state licensing law. All of our dealerships have on-site repair facilities employing highly skilled and automotive technicians for our state-of-the-art repair shops. The franchise dealers we represent represent hundreds of family-owned businesses who have invested billions, let me repeat that, billions of dollars to provide the infrastructure necessary to lawfully retail automobiles in Minnesota. This bill just seeks to clarify the long-standing intent of the Minnesota law that a motor vehicle manufacturer is prohibited from selling a vehicle directly to the consumer outside of the franchise agreement with the motor vehicle dealer. This franchise dealership network, which has been in place since the earliest days of the auto industry, has worked very well. And although it's true that we are indeed concerned about protecting our investments, you should also consider the importance of the state's longstanding policy requiring a franchise dealer to be the interface between the global automaker and the consumer, that being there as a member of the community is, it makes a big difference in those situations. For instance, consider what happens when an automaker goes out of business. In just recent memory, we've seen several lines such as Oldsmobiles, Pontiacs, Hummers, Saabs, Daewoos, and Isuzus, and other lines, other vehicles which no longer exist, find that their customers have access to their services and parts through their dealers, through dealerships. Long after that manufacturer has disappeared. The fact is that because there was a franchise dealership in the equation, many consumers continue to have access to these parts and repairs even after the manufacturer has closed its doors. In a few minutes, you'll hear from an out-of-state car company that does not currently sell vehicles in Minnesota. And they'll tell you that they need special treatment because they don't want to abide by Minnesota's requirements of the franchise dealership network. And they'll tell you that they have an innovative product that should not be prohibited. And we are in complete agreement that they have a very cool product that features cutting-edge technology and deserves all the accolades and awards it has earned. However, let's be clear, this bill is absolutely not about discriminating against this car company. Members, every problem you're about to hear is not due to the state's laws or anything about this bill. We have several established Minnesota dealers who would love to sell their product. All we want is a simple contract between them and the licensed new car dealer. We have serious concerns additionally about the competitive balance of not passing this bill, even further concerns about carving out a special exemption for this company that does not even have a presence here in Minnesota. Why should one car company be permitted to sell directly to consumers when every other manufacturer, and there are 70 different manufacturers here in Minnesota, including other niche, high-end green manufacturers such as Fisker Karma, have a dealership network in place in this state? For all those reasons, members, I encourage you to pass Senate File 679 in its current form. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Milner, Ms. Schlander.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Alyssa Schlander. I'm also with the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association. I really have nothing further to add. I just thought I'd be here for questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions, members? All right.
Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, testifiers, for your testimony. Just have a question regarding if you can point to, just so I understand really what you mean by unfair competition, any specific or concrete examples that you can point out or scenarios that this would cause an unfair competition to a dealer, just so I can picture and have more information.
Senator Smith.
But I'm just thinking we might be, could be wrong on this, I think we might be jumping ahead to the, what I think is a proposed amendment. We're talking about something that's not in the bill. Talk about it.
Well, I think Senator Franzen was asking for the underlying reason for the bill itself. Why is this bill being brought forward?
Mr. Chair, Senator Franzen, I can probably answer her question. The franchise dealership network as it exists now, as Mr. Milner said, in order to have a new car dealer's license in the state of Minnesota, one of the many requirements in order to be in compliance with your license is to have an existing contract between yourself and the auto manufacturer. Those contracts oftentimes allow the manufacturer to impose pretty onerous requirements on a dealer that the manufacturer gets to direct the dealer as to what kind of facility they're going to have. I mean, honestly, they're very prescribed contracts, down to the color of the tile on the floor in the men's room, as some of these contracts. So the manufacturer gets to control how their product is branded, but the dealership takes on the responsibility for those costs. So if we allowed a manufacturer to become a licensed dealer, That's where we feel that they would have an unfair unfair advantage, because then you would have an auto manufacturer competing directly with a dealer, and their ability to control costs that are in such a way that a dealership doesn't have control over the same costs in that equation.
So, Ms. Schlander, what about those instances? I understand that argument when there are licensed franchise dealers in a particular state, because that's how the manufacturer has chosen to sell its product in that state. What about those instances where a manufacturer has opted not to sell its product through a licensed dealer? That scenario that you just described wouldn't hold up. But now this bill would button up that option and foreclose and prevent it entirely. What is the argument there?
Mr. Chair, the answer to that is that then you would have that manufacturer's that particular manufacturer competing with dealerships that sell, you know, like products. And again, the way that we have prevented this unlevel playing field in Minnesota is to make sure that all manufacturers are on a level playing field. So that, for instance, I know that we're all about to hear from Tesla today. Tesla were able to sell directly to the consumer. They would be in direct competition with another very high-end innovative electric car company, namely Fisker, who does actually have a dealer here in Minnesota. And so we've got, you know,
Ms.
a presence
Schlander,
here in Minnesota.
Why is that for us to determine? I mean, Fisker could perhaps opt not to sell through a dealer. Why is it for us to determine which method, which route adds value or doesn't add value to the consumer and to the market? I have a basic philosophical inquiry about why we're making that determination about the marketplace and how it's formed and shaped in Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I think that that state law does that quite regularly, but what we are trying to do with this bill is clarify. There are currently no passenger automobile manufacturers that have a license to sell their product directly to consumers, because we have decided in this state that the way that we distribute new motor vehicles, which, by the way, is one of the most regulated and most expensive products that a consumer is going to purchase in the marketplace, we've decided that to have a local licensed dealer is in the best interests of the car buying public.
So, because it is the way it is what I'm hearing. So, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question. Has there ever been a situation besides Tesla or Fisker that there has been a manufacturer that sold directly? Or you said currently. So has there ever been a case where another, I don't know if Mini Cooper or any other brand that you've mentioned before, has had that hurdle to overcome? Or has there been any other way that cars could be sold directly through the manufacturers in the past in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Senator Franzen, not to my knowledge, all passenger motor vehicles have been retailed through an independently owned dealership.
I have Senator Carlson, then Osmek, then Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Carlson.
And I believe Ms. Schlander, how many brand names are available in Minnesota? And do they all sell this way through this method of distribution?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I think we have 70 brand names that are retailed here in Minnesota. And, yes, they do all sell through a licensed new car dealer.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
Ms. Schlander, is this did we not at one time have manufacturer-owned franchises in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I'm just looking at my colleague who represents all the major motor vehicle manufacturers, and neither one of us are aware of a time where a motor vehicle manufacturer owned a retail facility in Minnesota, or anywhere, really.
So, Ms. Schlander, that that continues to beg the question, why the change, why creating a new cause of action, you know, why the change for the bill if it's never been a problem in the past? What problem are we actually solving?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the way this bill started out life at the beginning of this session was that we were looking for some clarity in the law. We noticed a discrepancy, and given some conversations at the national level, we thought that we had a fairly easy clarification bill and got the auto manufacturers to be neutral on what we were trying to accomplish with our language. Wasn't until really just last week that we became aware of anybody being opposed to what we were trying to accomplish here.
Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I guess I'm confused why we wouldn't want to have some competition. I mean, what we're doing here is we're embedding, I think, a certain delivery model. Decades ago, we had certain delivery models. Why would the state want to become involved in manipulating service delivery models? I mean, a prime example of this one would be Apple computers. Mm-hmm. Apple now has opened stores directly from the manufacturer to sell their products in Minnesota. Very exact same concept that the manufacturer is, in essence, cutting out the middleman, which unfortunately would be the auto dealers. America has been built on cutting out the middleman and delivering services directly at a better cost to the consumer, which is what the consumer and the citizens of Minnesota would ultimately like. Now, granted, I don't think I would buy a vehicle from the internet directly without a manufacturer or without a dealership to take it to and fix it. But why wouldn't we want to allow a new service model such as the one presented to be implemented in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Senator Osmick, I am so glad that you asked that question, because I think what you just asked is exactly why we want to have independently owned auto dealerships and not a distribution model that relies on the manufacturer. As you know, today, everybody, I'm sure, around this table has purchased a motor vehicle from a dealership before, and you have the best delivery model there because you have competition amongst the dealerships. You can play Walzer off of Luther or whoever you want to get a better deal for the purchase you're about to make, because the dealer buys the inventory from the manufacturer. So you've got, you know, almost 400 independently owned retailers who own those products that they're trying to retail to you. If we're going to allow a distribution system that allows only the manufacturer to retail that product to you, guess who has no competition in the system anymore? The manufacturer.
Well, Mr. Chair, and
Senator Osmick,
to the testifier, well, but you're taking one factor out of this equation, is that by allowing direct from the manufacturer into the equation, you create an additional competitive part of the marketplace itself, that you would have Walzer and you would have Luther and you'd also have Joe's Place, for lack of a better term, that you would be adding additional competition into the marketplace, which would be better for the consumer, because then instead of Walzer and Luther being the only competitors, now you'd have Joe's Place as the competitor, which would open and provide either better service or a lower price. Wouldn't that be
true? I think Joe's Place would be the manufacturer's place.
Right, and that's what I'm saying, is that adding the manufacturer, Senator Benson, would create an additional level of competition, which would ultimately be better for the consumer, wouldn't it?
Well, then you wouldn't need retailers, I guess. You know, that's where you're going, you know. And I think the retailers, at least where I go in Edina and South St. Paul, are doing a wonderful job, and it's very competitive. And you want to give it all over to the manufacturers? I don't think you do. That's my opinion. And that's why we're here. The manufacturers agree with us, and the retailers agree with us. And we worked hard to get everybody on board. And, you know, they're not asking for this, the manufacturers. And also, well,
Senator Metz and members of the committee have to agree with you, too.
And again, let me just repeat, I think it's monopolistic if just the manufacturers come in. They don't need you, Mr. or Mrs. Retailer.
Yes.
You know, we're going to do it on our own. You know, that's not competition. That's monopolistic.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chair, my question is, I don't want to get ahead of, I think there might be more testifiers than usually. I know you prefer to have testifiers before.
Okay.
So I'll hold back if you want to do that.
Yeah. All right. Very good. We do have other folks who want to testify. We do have Senator Franzen, and I also know that Senator Jensen was in the queue to ask a question. And sorry, Senator Westrum, you wanted to wait?
Yeah, I'll wait.
Okay.
I'll wait.
All right. Senator Jensen, do you want to ask your question now?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment real quickly to some of the conversation about, Senator Osmek, what you were bringing up, allowing the manufacturer. This reminds me a lot of vertical integration, which we fought really hard in the egg industry. When the product that you're looking at is only available from a few, you know, we say 70, but the product is so big, there is a difference there. And I think we have to be careful and at least keep in mind that that vertical integration, when you manufacture it and you sell it, you do have control of price, and that will affect consumers.
Thank you. Senator Franzen, were you in the queue?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm not against auto dealers or manufacturers or competition or the market. I'm just trying to have the information that I need to make an informed decision, and that's why I'm the point of my questioning. So partly is Senator Osmek referenced cutting the middleman. Can you articulate the value of having an auto dealer being that middle person, middleman between the purchaser and the manufacturer? Can you articulate that? And then maybe you know how other areas, I know Polaris manufacturers here, I believe they need a license to sell their product, but maybe you can also elaborate there. And I mean, it's not a car, but it's maybe a vehicle.
Senator Metzen.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Franz, I'm not sure I answer that, but in my mind, it always gets back to competition. You know, I could go to Key Cadillac, or I could go at the McCarthy, and I go to your area. I go to Key Cadillac at Edina, by the way. But and it works out pretty good, And quite frankly, another thing in my judgment, that I'm drifting a little bit here, but a couple of my dealers, I know them. My kids used to play ball with them. Some people go to church with them. Like your insurance person, where you get close to them and you trust them, and there's some of that in my thinking. Now, the manufacturer, I'm sure he's a wonderful person, or he or she, and but I don't know. That kind of, in my mind, enters into it. The friendship. I know the Ferry Motor people in South St. Paul. I'm in the chamber with them. They're my buddies. I trust them, and I suppose I could learn to trust the manufacturer or somebody there. So, but that's part of my thinking. So, and it's competition. So. I don't know if you have anything to.
Well,
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I didn't answer everything.
Well, it does to a certain extent, but for instance, when I'm going to buy something online, and I'm thinking out loud, and I've talked about examples as well, like craft beer. Like right now, there's a market, there's a way it works in Minnesota. There's laws in Minnesota that says, you know, whatever tier system we have, but now we have craft beer, and you know they're producing it here, and. So the market evolves is my point. And when I make a decision as a consumer, I take into account where my service provider is. If I'm going to buy an electronic, can I take it to be fixed at the Apple store? Do I have to mail it in? That's convenience. So I do have concerns about manipulating or changing the market as it evolves, because I think there is something positive to that too. But to the extent that it hurts Minnesota businesses, and auto dealers have to take that into account, too. I just don't know if we have enough information, frankly, in front of us to really make that determination. So that's why I think this needs to be a bigger discussion.
Just a quick shout out to that service provider. I don't know. Where I go, I know what service I'm getting. I mean, you know, they're dependable, they're honest, and it's working pretty well. So on that remark about service providers, I, for one, am very comfortable where I buy my cars, and they're very congenial. They're happy to see me and happen to charge me big money. And anyway, the service provider thing, I understand where you're coming from, but if you buy something on the internet, I suppose it's a little harder to get a thing serviced than if you go to your car dealer that you know.
All right, did anyone else want to jump in before we take additional testimony? All right, we have Mr. O'Connell.
I'll sit here. Yeah, you guys.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Senator, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify here today. I'm truly grateful for that. My name is Dermot O'Connell, and I'm a representative of Tesla Motors. Tesla Motors, for those of you who haven't heard of us before today, is a small but growing rapidly manufacturer of all electric vehicles. In fact, by industry acclaim, we are probably the leading manufacturer. We are a company that was born around the idea of catalyzing the mass market for EVs. EVs have many benefits. I won't bore you with them. They have environmental benefits. They have benefits associated with reduction of oil dependency and all sorts of economic issues beyond that. We've developed this technology ourselves. We deployed it in our first car, known as the Tesla Roadster. We deployed 2,500 of those vehicles over a three-year period around the country and around the world. We are now producing our second vehicle. It's known as the Model S. It's a 5+2. Actually, you could call it a 7-passenger vehicle. Notable about all of our electric vehicles and a stark differentiator between us and the EVs that came before us is that our vehicles are long range. The Tesla Roadster was able to drive 250 miles on a single charge, and the Model S is able to drive 300 miles on a single charge. This is essentially breaking open the market for EVs, we believe. And I was counseled to point out that with that sort of capability, you could essentially drive a Model S from the Twin Cities north to the Boundary Waters and places beyond that. So it's truly taking all of the traditional restraints or constraints of an electric vehicle out of the equation. I'd like to point out here, as some of you have noted, that under current law, Tesla Motors is planning to come to Minnesota. There is no prohibition of an OEM that has never had a franchise dealer selling directly to customers. We had, prior to the emergence of the amendment proposed by the Dealers Association, been negotiating a lease at the Mall of America for a retail facility, and significantly, because it was noted here today, a service center in Edina. We already have a number of vehicles in Minnesota. They were purchased by Minnesota residents. They include Roadsters and they include Model S, and in fact we have some owners here today. We are anxious to come to Minnesota to service the vehicles that are already here, to provide the whole fulsome level of service that Senator Metzen referred to before. We have every interest in doing as good or better a job than anybody else servicing any vehicle. And significantly, we are making major investments in our facilities and positing that we will be employing 24 people in our first year. I'd also note that we are the small player on the block. I mean, we're talking about putting several hundred vehicles in this market in our first year of operation here. That's less than 0.1% of the total vehicle marketplace here in Minnesota. And so truly, we are the small player. The reason that we sell our vehicles direct is fundamental to our mission. We believe that we are the best positioned to educate the population about the merits of our vehicles, how they work, and then to service them ourselves to make sure that they have an excellent customer service experience. We do this all over the country right now. Where we don't have service centers, we, in fact, go to people's homes. We're that intent. Our position is that with this business model, we can entirely align everybody's interests from the company through our service centers, through our sales centers and our service centers to the customer so that everybody is being taken care of in the way that they deserve, and introducing this technology, this breakthrough technology, in a way that will serve the broader market. And as the tide rises underneath Tesla Motors, we'll create the opportunities for other manufacturers who are also offering EVs in this state. The environmental benefits are many. We believe that it's a perfect match for this market. But I'm very concerned that the amendment as proposed, which would effectively fence us out of the market, because it would prohibit any OEM. It would change the law so that any OEM, us principally, would not be able to sell here. I was counseled not to use the term monopoly, But since it was used by two folks on the other side, I will just posit an opinion, and I think it goes to Senator Franson's points and others. You'll excuse me if I don't note you. That what is essentially, if this amendment were to be adopted as proposed, it would effectively create a monopoly channel through which any seller of a vehicle would have to move their product. And so we would be encumbered with all the costs and complications of selling our products through that market. And this is a conscious decision that we've made at a strategic level, at a corporate level, and as we deploy ourselves around the country, that we can't bear right now, that we shouldn't bear under the law. We want to be good citizens. We have been good citizens everywhere. We want to obtain – we have been entrained to obtain a license here, both for sales and service purposes. There is no intent under any circumstances to evade the law. And please check me on this. Everywhere we've operated, even under restrictive conditions, we've made every effort to comply. And so I would ask you to really consider our position in that light, and I would be very happy to answer any of your questions.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connell. Questions, members? Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why not get a franchise license and sell to the franchise?
If I could go back, I'm sorry?
Go ahead, Mr. O'Connell.
It goes back to the point I was making about aligning our interests. Our fundamental interest is to educate a public that is not familiar with this new technology, which is innovative and which requires some support. And then, too, once that transaction is accomplished, to service that vehicle as only we, the developers of the technology, are best prepared to do.
So, Mr. O'Connell, I'll ask you the same question I asked Ms. Schlander. So if in fact, Tesla Motors decided to start selling their cars through a franchise licensed dealer in Minnesota, do you agree that it would be fair then for Tesla to not then go and also sell in Minnesota directly to the consumer?
Yes. If I'm not being a lawyer, let me make sure I'm interpreting your question directly.
Not either. So
yeah,
we're
okay.
Picking it up here. I got a lawyer right here.
I am
let me go back up a little bit and say that we understand the intent of the law in Minnesota, and frankly, it manifests itself in many states, and that is to protect franchise dealers from the predations of larger OEMs who might come in and compromise the substantial investments that some of these family businesses have made. We respect that.
OEM members is an original equipment.
I'm sorry,
manufacturer.
Yes, the manufacturers. I should use the industry nomenclature. So our intention is, I mean, we hurt no one effectively by coming in and operating in this fashion. In fact, I think as some of you have noted, we open up further competition in the marketplace by offering an innovative model for selling our product, much as Apple has done in their sector, much as other companies have done in their sectors. And I might also note that ours is this idea as embodied in the law in Minnesota, I betray my local origins, is enshrined in many industries where franchise businesses work, where there are hybrid models, where some businesses have manufacturer-owned retail and others operate through franchises, and it works very amicably. And frankly, probably through competition, creates a better consumer experience overall.
Senator Jensen, I apologize for stepping on your line of questioning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you testifying that a franchise is not going to be able to deliver what you were saying? Because we had heard in prior testimony that there's a contract, and they even go down to, like, tiles on the floor so that right. – are you testifying that that's not a model for you because they won't be able to deliver those types of things?
I want to make sure I'm answering your question correctly. The franchise system doesn't work for us, not for the reasons that my colleague mentioned. It doesn't work for us because it doesn't allow us to advocate for this technology in a committed fashion. It could be posited that a manufacturer selling multiple products, ours among them in that hypothetical world, would have every incentive to sell the product that they're familiar with and have historically sold, rather than supporting the innovative technology, which is somewhat more complicated to sell and certainly more complicated to service at this point.
Senator Jensen.
Okay, so I just want to be able to fully understand this. The franchise system that we have currently in Minnesota, because we don't have any other company that's doing it differently, is not adequate to promote your vehicle because it's different than other types of vehicles.
It is innovative in its own right, and it has historically suffered from competition with the existing technology, which is easier to sell because it's known.
Which is a different issue in my mind than what we're looking at in this piece of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Jensen. Senator Carlson.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr.
O'Connell.
O'Connell, okay.
Yeah. The first name is very difficult.
The models that you've made have all been made in your California factory, I believe.
Yes, sir.
O'Connell.
Yes, sir. They are. We are a little bit of corporate history. We are a $4 billion public company. We operate in California currently. That's where our technology is developed. Our vehicles are manufactured really from the wheels up in an old GM facility that we reopened 2 years ago in Fremont, California, the last auto plant west of the Mississippi, in fact.
Senator Carlson.
And what would you say, Mr. O'Connell, thank you, Mr. Chair, what would you say is the U.S. content in your product?
Yes.
It
sort of depends on what you want to measure, but the most conservative measurement, and I think it's the, I want to say Department of Commerce measurement, is 55% is local content. And to illustrate how that goes, while, of course, we don't make tires and windshields, cold rolled aluminum comes in one side of the plant and vehicles roll out the other. So we have full stamping, full paint facilities, body in white, which is when you weld the car together, final assembly when you put all the nice stuff into it, and we're even doing casting. So it's a highly vertically integrated operation, and that's for efficiencies purposes as well.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Connell, What arrangements do you have today for the owners of your cars in Minnesota for service and warranty work?
Right.
Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you. While we don't yet have a service center here, we have several levels of service. One, we can very often, because these cars are more and more computerized, we can very often triage issues remotely. And so we try and do that when we can. But when there's a mechanical issue that needs to be addressed, we deploy a service, what we call the Tesla Rangers. Excuse me, not my idea, but these are young folks, highly trained electrical engineers and mechanical engineers, who come out to whatever location is convenient for you, whether it's your driveway, your place of work, and service your vehicle. In the extreme, if it's a major mechanical issue, then we will during that session. Flatbed the car to our nearest service center. Right now, it's not in Edina, but we're very hopeful that it would soon be.
One more
final question, just for interest. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. O'Connell. The standards of DOT crash tests, all of those kinds of things. Your car fits and has passed all of those standards?
Absolutely.
Mr. O'Connell.
Yes, absolutely. We are, this is what's called Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards, FMVSS certified under NHTSA, the National Highway Transportation Safety Administration. We've designed this car to achieve a 5-star crash protection. We essentially wanted this vehicle competes with BMW 5 Series, Cadillac CTS, these sorts of vehicles. So we felt that we needed to engineer as good or better a vehicle than any of those, notwithstanding the technology. So we've achieved a 5-star safety testing, and these will be validated through outside testing. But I might also note that the vehicle was awarded Motor Trend's Car of the Year Award, which is a testament to both its engineering, design, and performance standards.
Thank you.
All right. I have Senator Tomassoni, Pratt, Westrom, Jensen.
And Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tesla Rangers, not to be confused with Iron Rangers. Okay, so.
Although kind of the same.
They might fit in somewhere. I don't know. But, Mr. Chairman, I think you own a Prius, if I'm not mistaken. And
no.
Don't you? You used
I,
to? You used
no, I
to.
Don't actually own a car.
Oh, you don't own? Did you used to?
No.
Okay. Well, one of your reps do.
Frank Hornstein owns a Prius, yes.
Yes, and Representative Kahn owns one.
Representative Kahn, but she's not in my district.
And although Toyota, I can't keep you Minneapolis.
I can't keep the range.
We lump you guys all in one group just like you lump us in one group. So. My point is, I think that when Toyota came out with the Prius, granted they had dealerships already, but when they came out with the Prius, that was a new technology, and it was probably confusing to the people who sold the car. And in fact, it didn't even work real good when it first came out. I remember Representative Kahn telling me how she was losing power when she would go down the freeway. However, it went through the dealership system in order to be sold. And I know that, for example, up on the Iron Range, there's a place called Iron Trail Motors that sells not only Toyota, but it sells Chevrolet and it sells Chrysler products. And so this doesn't seem to be any different to me than what those places are doing, in that you've got manufacturers who go through dealerships, and they're all different types of dealerships. And so it seems to me that your product would fit in really good in a dealership setting, because it's new, it's different, and the salesman would probably want to promote it because of the fact that it's different, just like the Prius was. And you could have Iron Trail Motors with Toyota, Chrysler, Chevrolet, and Tesla if you wanted to.
Mr. O'Connell.
Senator, I appreciate your point, and I'm not here in any way to critique the dealer model. I would note, however, that a significant differentiator between the Toyota experience with the Prius and our experience with our own vehicle is millions and millions of dollars in consumer advertising, which we do not engage in. And so that heightens the need for the upfront education that is not typically part of a dealer experience. Where the transactions tend to be, notwithstanding the significance of the purchase to any individual, it tends to be a more rapid experience. So we find that the investment that we make in in-person education, while it might not manifest itself immediately in a sale, that over the course of time, as that relationship is nurtured, does indeed result in an affirmative transaction. With those facts as differentiating ourselves from the Toyota experience, I'd submit that we still believe empirically, based on the prior experience with other manufacturers who have introduced EVs with limited success, and I would actually even note the company that was mentioned to you earlier, Fisker, which is a company that's struggling greatly. I don't know their situation here in Minnesota, but they have struggled with a number of issues, and I don't. My understanding is that I'll just leave it there.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the answer, but it seems to me that making an exception for your automobile company suddenly opens the doors to all manufacturers to go somewhere outside of the dealership model, and the proverbial camel's nose under the tent is something that we're dealing with right here, I would encourage you to consider the dealership model and to not ask for a special exemption for yourself, because I think we create a huge problem if we start going down that road.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. O'Connell, it sounds like Senator Tomasoni and I are kind of going along a very similar line, and in that I'm concerned with consistency. I believe Senator Metzen's bill is trying to preserve the original intent of the model that we've got here in Minnesota, and I'm concerned that if Tesla is allowed to open a dealership, what would keep Ford, GM, Volvo, on from dissolving their franchise agreements and opening up corporate stores? So I don't know if you can talk about consistency and how you see that fitting in with Senator Metzen's bill.
If I could,
Mr. O'Connell.
With due respect, I would submit that the law as it exists right now, the law that we were hoping to come to Minnesota under, has provided more than adequate protections for your local dealers, as there is no empirical evidence that Ford, GM, or any other large manufacturer has attempted, to my knowledge, to enter the market with its own stores and thus create unfair competition with existing dealers. Very simply put, I would say that the protections exist already. and that the evidence is before us. The 70 dealerships, or however many were mentioned, are free of that sort of predatory competition, if you will.
Thank you.
Senator Westrum, then Jensen, then Kiffmeyer.
Mr. Chair, and I guess I'm interested for an answer from Mr. O'Connell and then the auto dealers. And I think they'd be the ones to answer this, but did I understand from you, if this bill doesn't pass, current law works fine for Tesla. The law as it's existed for decades doesn't change. Your business model fits into Minnesota.
Mr. O'Connell.
Or does it not, does the current law not allow you to retail?
To be Mr. O'Connell.
Thank you for the question. To be very clear, the law as it exists right now makes it possible for us to come to Minnesota with no changes whatsoever, and noting once again that we would abide by every element of the regulations as they exist as far as licensing and servicing and so forth.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Westrum,
if we could hear from the auto dealers, because my understanding originally was they think the law is unclear and doesn't allow you to come here, hence the clarification of the bill, which is also what their original intent was. Could they answer the same question?
Ms. Schlander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum. That's correct. Kind of, you're both correct. What the law says now is that in order to be a licensed new car dealer in the state of Minnesota, one of the requirements of the state for you to maintain your, good standing as a licensed dealer is that you have a franchise agreement in place with an auto manufacturer. We thought that was that provided some unclarity in our law, because an auto manufacturer would not have a franchise agreement with itself. And since we have never had an auto manufacturer become a licensed new car dealer in the state of Minnesota, we thought that is what needed clarification, and that's what our bill is trying to do, is to maintain the longstanding tradition that manufacturers manufacture and dealers retail.
So, Mr. Chair, do you agree or believe the current law, if not changed, does allow Tesla to come in and sell? And the caveat that I thought I heard from Mr. O'Connell was something about not having a prior dealership in the state. Is that the caveat we are talking about here? And if so, do you agree that the current law, if not changed, allows you to continue and Tesla to continue with their plan?
Ms. Schlander.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, I am not sure that I am qualified to answer that question. I think that's where we believe that there is some ambiguousness in the law, because it clearly says that in order to get your new car dealer's license that you have to have a franchise agreement with an auto manufacturer, and I don't know how an auto manufacturer
Senator Westrum, why don't we have counsel help us? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, I was looking at the first section of the bill, which is in Chapter 80E, Point 13, unfair practices by manufacturers, et cetera. And the language that's stricken out of ADE is language that currently states it's unlawful for a manufacturer to compete with a new motor vehicle dealer in the same line make operating under an agreement or franchise from the same manufacturer. So I think in terms of unfair business practice, and Ms. Schlander can correct me if I'm misunderstanding that language, but under current law of unfair business practice, if a manufacturer comes in and there is not a franchise that is selling that manufacturer's product, the manufacturer would be able to sell directly But if there is a franchisee that is selling the same product, then the manufacturer would not be able to sell directly.
There's a real-world example. I don't know if it took place in Minnesota or not, but Krispy Kreme donut shops were opened up under franchise agreements, and then Krispy Kreme decided to go and sell their donuts directly in grocery stores. And the franchise owners successfully sued Krispy Kreme for undercutting their business, you know, undercutting, you know, the what they thought was the agreement that the sole outlet for Krispy Kreme donuts would be their shops and their stores, and they had that franchise agreement, and then Krispy Kreme started going to grocery stores and selling Krispy Kreme donuts and at Target, Senator Franz, and grocery stores and places like that, and they successfully sued. The current law for automobile manufacturers and dealers would capture that kind of activity. So if Tesla were to have a franchise agreement or be selling through a licensed dealer in Minnesota already, they couldn't come in and sell directly to the consumer today. They could not. But if they didn't, they could.
Mr. O'Connell, I guess both of them. Did you agree with counsel's interpretation? And that's what I'm understanding is it's if Tesla was here prior with a dealer arrangement, you couldn't come in and undercut your dealer.
Yes,
is that
sir.
Right?
Yeah. Under that hypothetical, if we already had a dealer here, we could not come in and open a store as we would do. But under the current law, as we have no dealers, and there is no harm to those hypothetical dealers. We can. Our interpretation of law is, I think, consistent with as represented here. We can sell direct.
And Ms. Schluter, Mr. Chair, do you disagree with that, or do you agree that is the crux of the argument?
Ms. Schluter.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Westrum, I think what we are getting confused about is that we're talking about two different sections of law. The section of law that Ms. Berzovsky was referencing is the section of law that regulates the contracts between a manufacturer and a dealership, and therefore a manufacturer could not open a store in direct competition with one of its dealers, and that would be unfair under those contract agreements. What I am also referencing is the Minnesota dealer licensing law, which is in 168, Chapter 168, and that is where it says that in order to be a new car dealer, to get a new car dealer's license, one of the requirements of getting that license is to have a franchise agreement in place. So I think we're sort of talking about two different sections of law that come into play here.
Mr. O'Connell, can you respond to that? Are you not going to be able to get a license under the current law anyways?
We believe that we would be able to obtain a license under the current law.
And Mr. Chair, if I can just ask, why do you believe that? Have you had conversations with the Commerce Department? Have they issued you a license? Have they written you a letter or just had
so,
attorneys advise you that?
With apologies, I'm not the I've not been the action officer, and I'm not a lawyer by trade on this issue, but I understand very clearly from my colleagues. That our interpretation by our in-house and a specialty counsel on this is that we could obtain a dealership under the current law as written.
Okay.
And we have had those conversations. I can't testify to whom, but of course those would be moving in parallel with the lease negotiations which we've been engaged in with the Mall of America and with in Edina.
And, Mr. Chair, I think this is my last question for this round. The lease negotiations with Mall of America, what is that? Is that where you'd have cars and set up a dealership sell your cars to prospective buyers?
So, yes. The gentleman referenced the Apple store construct. We stores, as they were, are located in malls such as Mall of America, where we operate sort of a boutique. It's not a dealership in the conventional sense in that there's not a lot of inventory. Ours are our order and sales process is a custom order sales process. So the customer would come into the location of the Mall of America, engage with Tesla sales associates, be educated in the technology, the car, be walked through the process, and if comfortable would then proceed with the sales transaction. The car would then follow some months later as it was built.
So, members, we are going to have to move this along. We have two more bills on the agenda. We're trying to wrap by 5 so we can all get to our caucuses prior to floor sessions. So moving along, we have Senator Jensen, then Senator Kiffmeyer, and then Senator Miller, and then Senator Franza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could a franchise open one in the Mall of America and sell your cars?
Mr. O'Connell.
I don't think that there would be any prohibitions to a dealer opening up a store in the Mall of America, but we would not do so.
You just don't like that model.
For the reasons I've articulated, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment.
All right.
And it might be easier for the members to have the language of this amendment. And it has been submitted before, ready for distribution. So if they would go ahead and do that.
What is the amendment number?
Amendment number is A13.
0134. Okay, great. Thank you. All right.
Thank you for.
Senator Kiffmeyer moves the A13-0134 amendment. It's coming around.
So, Mr. Chair and members,
Senator Kiffmeyer.
What my amendment does is I think the sense of trying to find an apt compromise at saying we understand the current automobile dealers and they're wanting to not have a manufacturer of one of their current, that's current law, to make that clear. If that's what they see, but also understanding that if someone has not had a franchise in the state before, current law would allow them, the Krispy Kreme kind of case that you mentioned. But what this does is allow them to have that and yet to also make sure that in this case, the exception for Subdivision 2 would be a manufacturer or distributor of only all-electric motor vehicles who owned and operated a new motor vehicle dealership in the United States on or before March 1st, 2013, and has never sold its line make in the United States through an independent franchise, may engage in one of the activities listed in Subdivision 1, Paragraph 1, at any location within the state, and may obtain a new motor vehicle license under Chapter 168, as mentioned prior. So what it basically does is hopefully give clarification to one entity and also continue current law in regards to an OEM opening up here in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Metzen.
Mr. Chairman, I'm here to promote in the past Senate File 679. These folks have been in. I'm the type of senator that tries to meet middle ground and big people together, and I know they've been working pretty hard for the last 2 weeks, and quite frankly, I don't think we're there. And I thought there might be a way to do this. So I think on this one, it's generally not my style to kind of throw it up, but I think we'll let the committee decide on this one. And I'm here, again, promoting the passage of 679, and I think this is a decision that I wanted to get it done before we got here, but I guess we didn't get it done, and I don't know if that's my fault or if it's just impossible to get it done. So that's I'm clearly in the middle of the fence here. No. But I want to pass Senate File 679. So.
All right. Thank you, Senator Metzen. Mr. O'Connell.
If I might, and let me just say that I'm very grateful for the extended hearing that you've given to me here today. The advantage of the amendment, as has been proposed, we believe, is that it preserves the intent of the existing law, that it honors the amendment as proposed by the Dealers Association, and that it yet preserves our ability to operate and to bring this promising technology to Minnesotans.
Anything further on the amendment, members? So, Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, and I guess guess just comment, and maybe the witnesses have reaction.
That's
I guess we've got two questions here. Do we? There's part of me that thinks about the entity that studied state law or ordinances locally, built a business plan, and they feel, I mean, they're moving forward, and all of a sudden government tries to change what is literally in the rules in the middle of the game. It seems like this amendment preserves that scenario and potential unfairness from happening. That seems to make sense. Down the road, if Tesla 2 comes along, and maybe the author of the amendment, do they get an exemption, or do they not get to come into Minnesota and sell their product if they want to sell it the same way as Tesla?
Senator, is that a question to Senator Kiffmeyer?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Westrom, it seems to me that the current law still applies. In other words, if you have not had a franchise in the state of Minnesota, that's current law, and then the OEM is able to set up a manufacturer sales point. And so that is still in place, so it doesn't matter which company it is. It's just that it's current law, and this amendment helps to preserve that current law and yet give the protection. So I don't know how else to answer that, Mr. Chair.
If Senate File 679 were to pass, that would not be the case. Current law would go away.
Yes, without the amendment.
And, in fact, the dealers would have the right to sue anyone, any OEM who came in to try to set up. Because a right of action is created in the bill as proposed.
And that's my question, Mr. Chair. Tesla is the only one I'm aware of right now, and I've been familiar with this company for several years. But do we stymie innovation if we just give it to Tesla? And maybe that's a fight or a question for another day if this bill passes. But if this amendment is riding along on this bill, then it becomes the exemption. But I think I'm understanding it correctly. We give Tesla their fair process in that they've studied our state laws, looked to set their business model up based on what's been in law for a long time, but a future one could not do this. Is that Mr. O'Connell, do you have thought on that, or Ms.
We could ask Mr. Berzovsky to answer that question. I think the answer to your question is
yes.
Okay. This is drawn fairly narrowly to respond to Tesla's circumstance and situation. So, all right. Who else wanted to speak on the amendment? Senator Thomas.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate Senator Kiffmeyer's attempt to make this different. But I think this is a carve-out, and it's a carve-out for one manufacturer, and you might as well just put Tesla in there, and where it says owned and operated. And so I think this makes an exception and does exactly what I said it would do before, in that it allows an exception to the law that's in place right now and allows somebody to get around the law without going through the dealership model. And I think that's exactly what Tesla wants to do, and that it creates now a potential for every dealership in the country to say, well, if they can do it, then we should be able to do it too. Or I mean, every manufacturer in the country to say, we can do it too. So, I think this is a carve out that we should not put in the bill.
All right, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
I believe that current law already allows Tesla to come in under current law, and they are the ones that have gone through using current law, and so my amendment is basically just preserving that. It's what was here before this bill came before us. So, but thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think it's confusing, so it'd be helpful to have counsel explain what this bill does, because I understand it as it being current law that Tesla can move in, whatever other company that has a similar model can come in right now, that's current law. This bill changes the current law completely in two different sections. So rather than having our testifiers argue their points and their constituencies, mm-hmm. It'd be good to have an objective opinion from counsel of what this bill does in the changing sections and really what the repercussions of the changes are. Because the amendment, as I understand it, Senator Kiffmeyer's amendment, is a carve-out to the proposed change in the current law. So it wouldn't be a carve-out for Tesla in the current law. Does that make sense? It would be a carve-out to the proposed legislation. Yes. But it's not the carve-out to the law, because the law is the law.
You are correct, Senator Panza, but to your request to have...
You could even follow DPS. I don't know if Pam McCormick is familiar with that. DPS would come in because
my girl's
looking
in
my direction.
Right.
That's why
Pam's here. All right, so... But did you want to... Yeah. But also, we have DPS here who might be able to help us as well. At least, I don't know, Ms. McCormick, are you... Do you have familiarity with these automobile manufacturer licensing standards in particular? And members, we do have to move along, really. Ms. McCormick.
Mr.
So
Chair.
So can you take a stab at Senator Franzen's question? Did you catch it? What does the bill do? Under current, what is the
well,
bill?
I would agree
what is current law and what does the bill change?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, Driver and Vehicle Services Director, I would agree with the way that the law was described by the author of the bill, and that's what I would agree with and would accept that interpretation. And that's I'm not an expert on dealer law, but that is what our staff have talked about when we reviewed the bill internally.
So to summarize, maybe Ms. Berzofsky can summarize how the author represented the bill. I don't want to take a stab at it. But I think we had the original discussion. You know, if, in fact, a manufacturer does not have a franchise in the state currently, they can sell directly to a customer. So there are protections against undercutting. That's in the first part of the bill. That's on page 2. And then it creates a private right. So the change would be what, Ms. Berzofsky? The change on 2.23 in that paragraph I. On page 2.
Mr. Chair. The change, there are a couple of changes in this bill, as I understand it, and I don't know that I could represent Senator Metzen's point of view exactly, but as I understand it, it is somewhat that 2.22 strikeout down to 2.27 is basically clarifying, because current law says that a manufacturer can't compete with a new motor vehicle dealer, but it doesn't really say what compete means. The new language says that the manufacturer can't own or operate directly or indirectly, et cetera, a motor vehicle dealership. So it seems to me that it explains and defines this notion of competition. And it changes terminology to cast it in terms of a violation. And then it creates this cause of action that, as I understand it, any new motor vehicle dealer is presumed to be injured if this clause is violated and would have standing to bring an action for violation of this clause. So I think, I don't know whether that's ever been tested in court, but it has not been a part of the statute before. And then in Section 2, that is part of the dealer licensing law, and that clarifies that a motor vehicle manufacturer is not required to be licensed. In other words, they don't have to be a dealer to sell to a dealer.
And then it goes on to say a manufacturer distributor may not obtain a new motor vehicle dealer license. So
which line are you? That's the real
5.20 to 5.21. Okay. And it creates some definitions. All right. Senator Franzen?
Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Carlson, to the amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Ms. Berzofsky. Does With this amendment, are we putting in an exception to all of the requirements in that section I? So does that mean that if Tesla chooses this business model, can they not change to, you know, like, let's say if they would see value added in going to a distributor, to a dealerships, does that mean that they can't change?
No. Senator Carlson, you'll see on line 1.8, it's permissive. It says may. I don't know. I don't see any prohibition on changing their business models or they change their mind. But Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, I agree. Under 1.9, it says that the described entity may obtain a new motor vehicle license, but it is permissive, so I think it would give them flexibility.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Berezovsky, you mean it would give flexibility that's beyond the flexibility that is in the law today?
Mr. Chair,
no.
I believe that that's the case.
Sorry.
No.
In today's law.
It's just
in the bill or the today, current law current or law. The bill?
Current law. Would uphold current law for Tesla.
Mr. Chair, it would uphold, I agree, it would uphold current law, but I hear a disagreement between Ms. Schlander and the Tesla representative as to whether Tesla would be able to obtain a new motor vehicle license. So. Under current law.
Okay.
And this clarifies that it would be able to obtain a dealer's license.
Senator Westrum, to the amendment.
Mr. Chair, to that point, Ms. McCormick, do you have any insight? Have you looked at – are you the one that would issue these licenses for a new dealer? Have you looked at – reviewed this at all under current law? Or maybe Tesla hasn't actually gotten to the point of making that
Ms. McCormick.
Application.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Westrum, we have not had Tesla has not presented us with a license application that I'm aware of.
And would it come to your office?
It would come to our office, correct.
Do you have an opinion on whether current law, absent this bill, current law would allow them to set up the model they're proposing?
Ms. McCormick,
yes.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, no, because we really haven't been involved in these discussions, so we haven't looked at that model. The amendment that we had talked with the dealer association with had to do with ensuring that people that were already licensed would be able to continue to be licensed. And with those exceptions that we had made, and so that we had worked with them on that particular amendment, but we were not aware of Tesla's interest in applying for a license. At least I am not at my level, and I am overseeing. We're just transitioning to a new program director in vehicle services, so I've been working closely with the managers and staff in that area, and I'm not aware of that application being presented to DVS.
And your no was you don't have an opinion on whether it works or not, just because you haven't simply looked at it to even form an opinion.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, yes, we would have to review it, and I would rely on our manager and legal counsel as to whether or not we'd be able to accept the license application.
Very good. Thanks.
All right. Members, I'm going to take a vote on the A13 amendment unless someone really has to say something.
We have a roll call, Mr. Chairman.
All right. A roll call has been requested. A roll call will be granted.
Chairman Dibble.
Yes.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Champion.
Yes.
Senator Franzen.
Yes.
Senator Jensen.
No.
Senator Kent.
Yes.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes.
Senator Miller.
No.
Senator Osmick.
No.
Senator Peterson. Senator Pratt?
No.
Senator Reinert?
Yes.
Senator Rest? Senator Senjum?
No.
Senator Tomasoni?
No.
Senator Westrom?
Yes.
And Senator Wieger?
No.
On a vote of 8-7, the amendment passes. Anything further on the bill, members? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I don't know if council can answer this or one of the testifiers, but under current law, can, say, Ford come in and sell direct to the consumer? Miss?
Council whispered no in my ear.
Okay.
And I think, Senator Miller, that's because Ford has franchise agreements.
Right. So now, if this, under current law, well, I guess we don't know under current law, but if there's a manufacturer that does not have a dealer, they can come to the state of Minnesota and sell direct. But if they currently have a dealer, then they cannot sell direct.
Senator Miller, under these, with the amendment, with the Kiffmeyer amendment? I'm sorry, under current law?
Under current law.
A dealer who does not, I mean, a manufacturer who is not working through a dealer can come to Minnesota and sell directly, yes.
No one else has a dealership.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. On Senate File 679, as amended, Senator Metzen, has Judiciary asked for this bill? It does create a new private right of action.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think the Judiciary Committee has asked to forward this bill, legislation, to them.
All right. And I know at some point it'll have to go to finance because it creates a fiscal implication for the state. So we'll go from Judiciary to finance.
You know, Mr. Chairman, I hate to say it, but I think this is a really confusing bill. And I'm just wondering if we should just lay it on the table until we can get some answers to some of the questions that some of the people have asked here.
All right.
Chairman, I think we ought to – I want to move this along. And
along.
We've got deadlines.
All right. We will abide by the wishes of the chief author. All in favor of Senate File 679 as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
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 Motion does not pass.
Mr. Chair, having voted on the prevailing side, I move to reconsider.
One division.
On the motion to reconsider, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
No.
The motion does not pass. So, Senate File
division on the vote, yes. The previous vote?
We've already moved on to a different, we've called that vote, Senator Wieger, and we've moved on to your vote to reconsider.
That's what you're asking for, right?
All right. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Metzen.
I think I thank you. I don't know. This is a defeat.
Senate File 486. Senator Dahl.
So I don't think they can. We'll see. That's right. The only thing I'm concerned about. Let me tell you.
Welcome, Senator Dahl. Senate File 486, Lasura County.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you. I have before you Senate File 486, and this is an agency bill, and I'll give you the short version, and I have Scott Peterson from MnDOT and the mayor of Lasura here to answer any questions that you might have. Really what we're doing here is something for a good thing for the city of Lasura and the state of Minnesota. What this proposal does is provide for relocation of the Lasura rest area on Highway 169. And the reason we're doing that is to, we're basically trying to move it across the street. We're doing that to allow Cambria the opportunity to expand their business. And so this legislation is really is an exemption for this project to allow a land transfer to a private party without going through the normal land relinquishment process that's in statute. And this transfer is contingent upon reaching an agreement for construction of the new rest area facility in this area. MnDOT has been approached by both the city and county through the Transportation Economic Development Program and by Cambria regarding the potential for future business development. And I believe they also have some plans for where that rest area may be very nearby. So that's what the bill does, and we're really optimistic about, you know, expanding an existing business for the city of Lasura, but as I mentioned, for the state of Minnesota. So that's the bill in a nutshell. And I don't know if maybe the mayor wants to weigh in. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
My name is
Welcome, Mayor.
My name is Bob Broder. I have the privilege of being the mayor of Lasura, and chair and senators. We in Lasura, as we're located on 169, are very fortunate to have a number of businesses in our community, and we very much encourage that in employment. Today I was reading in the newspaper about how Minnesota has seemed to be doing better in terms of its economics, about also its hiring is above the national average, which I'm very pleased to see. The present situation is one where we also look forward to increasing the number of employment that would come from the expansion of Cambria. Cambria presently is in an expanded mode, which looks to maybe add as many as up to 500 people with their new facility. And with this situation presently, without this ability to garner this particular acquisition, it would make them landlocked. This will allow them to expand as they foresee in the very near future to do another expansion, and would add approximately 250 more jobs to our economy in our area. And I know we're all interested in trying to keep our economy moving and moving forward. And so as a community, we certainly want to encourage that whole process. So
thank you.
Hopefully very much you'll consider this and pass it.
Questions for the mayor and members? Mr. Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The only thing I would add is Cambria approached us last summer to ask if we would be interested in moving our rest area to a new location in order to accommodate.
Mr. Peterson, can you just introduce yourself for the tape? Thank you.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Scott Peterson from MnDOT. And so we've been in conversations with them ever since. And one of the keys, of course, to making this work is being able to actually transfer the land to them should we reach some agreement on how things would be paid for and where the new rest area would be located. And so the purpose of this bill is to allow us to do that in the event we eventually reach an agreement with Cambria. And I believe everyone has a photocopy of a map, and in case you're having trouble figuring out where we're at, here, the Cambria facility is right here, and our rest area is just below that. Kind of towards the lower right-hand corner as you look at it. And they're marked, but it's very faint. But right now, Cambria, as I understand it, is in the process of expanding the building that you see on the map to the south towards our rest area. And as soon as they're able to, they want to then expand once again with another addition to their plant that I think is about equal size. And so we're, you know, we are very willing to work with them on this, and so that's why we're here today with this bill.
Great. Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Peterson, does the state already have the necessary property rights in the new location? Do we need to acquire them? Do we have a willing landholder?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Reinert, last I heard, which was yesterday, I think they are still trying to identify a new location for the rest area. The city already owns some land on the other side of 169. That's an industrial park. And so we had initially looked over there, but the last time we got together with the city and the county and the company, there was also some conversation about maybe there's a location on the east side of the road as well. And so they were all getting together and trying to work through those things. One of the key aspects of it is, you know, where do we build a new access to 169 that is capable of handling the traffic that's likely to use the new rest area?
Thank you.
Senator Reinert. Anything further, members? All right. Wow, I like – oh, Senator Senchum.
I think, you know, thank you, Cambria, you know. Speaking only for myself, I'm willing to trade a rest area for 500 jobs any day of the week, so we can work this out.
We'd like that, too.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Only because we're on this topic, I agree with Senator Senjum. Other states actually lease out their rest areas and let some private business come into them and generate some money out of them, and I've thought in our budget woes and the 21st century we're in, we're not in the same situation as our roads were when they first were built, the interstate highways and the four lanes. And so I just mention that because there's even a different model we could potentially look at to ensure rest areas, but also not have them be a coster to the state of Minnesota like they currently are. But anyways, good idea, good for jobs, and I think with all the different businesses along 169, this change is certainly proper.
All right. Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Westrom, to your point, we have included the possibility of adding, you know, commercial businesses to the development of a future site as well. I don't know if that will actually materialize, but we are actually discussing that as well with the city and the company.
Very good. Yes, and we'd be very interested in that.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Anything further, members? Does anyone have a motion? All right. Senator Westrom moves Senate file number 486 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
Gosh. Thank you very much.
Senator Dahl, I wish the last bill was like this bill. All right. Senator Charles. Someone's going to get him. There he is. So this member is Senate File 851. Anyone driving a Tesla is able to park diagonally in a parking. No, I'm just kidding.
Sorry, Senator, wrong bill. But, well, no, if it's a vehicle with, never mind.
Welcome, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Senate File 851, which makes some changes in disability parking options. And it's primarily related to the disabled parking or the parking spaces that are reserved for the disabled. And in some cases that these parking spots have been either not available or perhaps people are being sloppy in how they park in them. Maybe they're not authorized. And as it turns out, I'm having a photograph passed out that after I decided to sign on to this bill, went to a local restaurant and saw that there's a pair of parking spaces there that demonstrate both of these problems. What we're going to try to do is we're going to try to make require that the disabled parking signs are permanently placed so that they are not moved, are not so they're not out of place, and you can always identify where those parking spaces are. The second is that we're prohibiting parking in the striped areas of those spaces because people need to load and unload sometimes chairs and other things, or they have ramps, and that extra width is needed. So we want to prohibit any parking that's on those striped areas. And the third one is to allow parking in two standard parking spaces when there isn't handicapped spaces available. Now, you can see in the picture there, which I actually don't have one, but you can see the representation there. There are two spaces. One of them is covered with snow, and the other one is not obstructed, but it is not labeled. And the one that's labeled is the one that's covered up with snow. So if there was just a slight bit more snow, you would not be able to tell that there was a place available even, you know, because the one you can see, the piles are there. So this is something that I think we have great need for, and I have a testifier here that will be able to tell you perhaps her own situation.
Thank you. You did a very nice
job. Ms. Indicross.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Margot Imdick Cross, and I'm the accessibility specialist for the Minnesota State Council on Disability. We're a small state agency, and we're celebrating our 40th year of service to the state, so we've been around for a few years. The Council on Disability advises the governor, the state legislature, state agencies, and the public on disability issues. I'm testifying today in support of Senate File 851. This bill identifies three problem areas, and it proposes three specific risk solutions. The first proposed change is an amendment to Statute 169.34, Subdivision 1, where language is added to make it clear that parking is not allowed in the access aisle adjacent to a disability parking space, and that's that striped area that separates the two disability parking spaces in the picture. So according to current code, there's required to have an 8-foot, this would be required to be 8-foot or disability parking space, an 8-foot access aisle, and then another disability parking space. In 2007, we changed the state building code accessibility chapter to require new and renovated disability parking spaces to have this type of configuration where you had an 8-foot access aisle. And that provided greater access to people who used lift-equipped and ramp-equipped vehicles. And unfortunately, it soon became apparent that a lot of people just thought this was either an extra parking space or people thought, well, it's just an extension of my parking space. And so someone like myself or my director at the agency who have side lift-equipped vehicles, so we get in on the passenger side of our vehicle, we would pull into the space, we'd get out of our vehicle, and then somebody would pull in and block us out of our vehicle because they'd be parking on the striped access aisle. The change proposed in the bill would make it absolutely clear that this is a no parking space. Okay? And that would give us greater authority and code then to get these designated as no parking spaces. The second change is an amendment to Statute 169.346, where a subdivision is added to address the situation that when there is either no disability parking provided or an inadequate number of spaces provided, it would allow individuals with disabilities who have lift or ramp-equipped vehicles to park. Well, actually, it would allow extra access for individuals with lift or ramp-equipped vehicles. And people who have a disability parking certificate, or license plate would be allowed to park at an angle and essentially take up two spaces. This is typically rare, but it is already happening. And this is a parking technique that people are using currently. Unfortunately, for those of us who do use it, we're very nervous about getting ticketed and towed. So this would just authorize to do this and give us the confidence to do it. Last but certainly not least, the last change is an amendment to 169.346 subdivision 2, and it eliminates language that allows for movable disability parking signs. The need to move disability parking signs was provided at one time for snow removal purposes, but as these techniques have become more sophisticated and the equipment itself has become more precise, this option is no longer needed. This language conflicts with state building code requirements for a permanently posted sign, and those of us in the disability community can give you example after example of how these signs are moved around at random, stolen, or simply forgotten about after the snow removal takes place. These movable signs undermine disability parking requirements and the enforcement efforts of this important law. Recently, we received complaints on four different such areas. Hotel Sofitel, just this past weekend, the director of our agency went to Hotel Sofitel and pulled in looking for disability parking. Typically, there's three disability parking spaces there. Unfortunately, all the signs were up on a little mound of where somebody had stuck them a day earlier so that they could move this, you know, remove the snow, and nobody ever bothered to put them back. So they essentially had no disability parking provided in that lot, even though they, by code, should have had three spaces. Metro Petro on University Avenue, for those of you who are familiar with Metro Petro, down on 25th and University by the U of M, the sign was stolen. There was just gone one morning, and it took them over a year to replace it. JCPenney's at Rosedale has movable disability parking signs, and they're always in a different location. Colburn's Grocery Store in Sauk Center has movable. And I get the complaint was really verbal about that one. She said that it was so blatant. A customer actually parked in the disability parking space, didn't have the proper ID to park there, literally picked up the sign and moved it to a different space because they wanted the closest spot. The customer moved a sign so they could park closer to the store. Movable signs make it difficult to enforce disability parking laws. As with the last example, again, the non-disabled individual simply wanted a closer parking space, so he picked up the sign and moved it to another location. Some parking enforcement officers are reluctant to ticket when movable signs are involved in an offense, since they can't be sure of the facts. The proposed changes will make the disability parking law more responsive to the growing population of people with disabilities who use lift and ramp-equipped vehicles. They will also strengthen the enforcement efforts. Ms. Codd urges your support of this bill. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. And are there any questions, Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Ms. Imdick-Cross. We do have an issue, Senator Carlson, that Ms. Berezovsky would like to help us with, and that is your Section 1, parking in an access aisle, and that creates a petty misdemeanor. We already have a prohibition on that, and it's a what level of offense? Well, I'll let Ms. Berezovsky explain that. We might already account for this in our state laws.
Mr. Chair, under current law 169.346 disability parking areas, subdivision 1 provides that a person shall not park a motor vehicle in or obstruct access to a parking space or associated access aisle designated and reserved for the physically disabled on either private or public property, and that is actually penalized as a misdemeanor. So it conflicts with Section 1, which classifies parking in an access aisle as a petty misdemeanor.
Ms. Imdick-Cross.
I was contacted by the city attorney's office from St. Cloud last summer, and an individual had been parked in an access aisle, and they tried to ticket, and he was fighting the ticket, and they felt that there wasn't strong enough language in current law to prosecute or to impose any kind of a fine. And so we thought this language would make it clearer, because it's a list of, you know, specific areas where you're prohibited from parking. And I'm afraid I didn't, mm-hmm. The penalty itself, that part of the language, I didn't realize there was a conflict. But mm-hmm. We thought it was clearer if it had been listed in this section of the law, or at least that's what I was advised. So is there any way to resolve this with?
No. it could perhaps be resolved in judiciary. Senator Carlson, I'm not sure you want to go to judiciary. They're jammed. This bill won't pass. It won't get on their calendar. I'm just telling you.
Can you repeat where is the
My advice, existing? Senator Carlson, is that we just delete Section 1 because we already account for parking in aisles with a higher penalty. It's very close by the existing amendment that you're making. It's 169.346. So that's obviously just a couple of paragraphs or a couple of sections away from 169.34. What was your question, Senator Carlson?
Yep, I would accept that as a
okay
as an amendment.
Senator Carlson moves to delete Section 1. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. All right, questions, members? Senator Westrum.
I just raised this question to the author, and I thought about this after the fact or after the bill, and I understand the issue. I'm just wondering if there's issues with smaller businesses that sometimes a movable sign is a practical way that they're going to be able to offer this, or there might be a logical reason they need to move a sign, whether it deals with delivery or something to their business. And I guess I'd just like to think about this, or if there's anybody that's got concerns about this as far as, small businesses are usually the ones that have a harder time complying with new laws when we take out flexibility or make them more rigid. And so any thoughts on that, Senator Carlson or to the witness? It's something I'd like to maybe continue discussing.
Senator Carlson.
Senator, Mr. Chair, and Senator Westrum, recognize that could be a problem. Now, we did have a response from the Chamber of Commerce. They decided to remain neutral. And that was one of the things that I had brought up also. But at this point, I think if there's not every sign is semi-permanent, it's possible that there may be some way to get around the instantaneous issue where you need to move it because of some moving or something like that to pull it out. But I think the intent is to make it so that it's not easily stolen or that it's removed and then not replaced. And I guess I could ask.
And maybe we could follow up with the advocates afterwards. Something that's coming to mind is just, I mean, potentially if it's a movable one, it still needs to be affixed because there'd be a way to affix a movable sign somehow with a chain, if nothing else, to the ground. But I just think I'm talking out loud, and while I plan to support it, it's something I'd like to have us think about a little bit more if there's an unintended consequence or issue here that may result in less signs being available, rightly or wrongly, or intentional or unintentional. But anyways, just that's
Senator
my thoughts.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Senator Westman, I think there is a solution for that, and it might be just bolting it down, because you can always unbolt a sign too. Just something so that it's semi-permanent. And I guess what I have here is another testifier that may be able to shed some light on it too.
More unmovable than it is now.
Yes, more.
Ms. Kang.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrum, I will tell you in
Ms.
our
Kang,
conversations.
Please introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, Kim Kang with the Minnesota State Council on Disability. Mr. Chair, Senator Westrum, we did have conversations with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and they did put this by their small business, I think, subcommittee, and we did not really get any opposition there. I will tell you in terms of, installing a permanent sign, we did look at what the potential kind of, I guess, cost would be to a business. And what we found out was it's going to cost probably roughly $35 to $50 to install a sign permanently. So we kind of felt like that's a pretty minimal cost to a small business, not to say that's still not a cost, but just to offer that up as just additional information for you to consider.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Kang, maybe we can talk offline. I don't know offhand the actual requirement. Does every small business have to do this? Do some? Is there size exemptions? Is there retail versus wholesale type business exemptions? So those are just questions that are going through my mind. And while I think the chamber subcommittee is a good vetting place, I also think of the thousands of small businesses in my district that don't belong to the chamber, don't belong to NFIB, are just darn busy making a living, and I think about them as well, and I can't think of the unintended consequence right now other than I could foresee there being some, and that's what I'd like to think about a little more if we could follow up.
Like Ms. Imdick Cross had a quick response. We're running up against our
self-imposed
deadline.
Just a very quick response. Every parking lot is required to have, depending on the size, at least one disability parking space. And one thing that I think people need to understand and realize, too, that they can mount these signs to the building themselves. They can be as far as 8 feet. Code allows for at least 8 feet in front of the space. So as long as the space is within 8 feet of a building, the disability parking sign can be mounted to the building, and then there's no, you know, there's no moving that typically. So there are some creative solutions out there, but I just think we need to start moving away from these movable signs because they're not doing what they're intended to do, especially when, you know, in my neighborhood, an intoxicated college student walks off with it in the middle of the night because
cool.
they think it's going to look good in their dorm room. Yeah, and that's typically what happens in my neighborhood.
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson, I guess I'm not familiar with what a movable sign is. I'm even looking at your picture here and struggling with what would fit and what wouldn't, because if I look at this sign, you know, bolted to a stake, driven into the ground, I guess I don't consider that to be a non-permanent sign.
Mr. Chair, member, Senator Pratt?
This
would be considered a permanently installed sign. The signs we're talking about are the ones where you can literally pick them up and move them. You know, there are a number of locations that are still using them today, but they are. You pick them up, they're in a little base, and you just move them.
Yes, Senator Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Pratt, the one that is the example is the one that's missing here. There are two parking spaces there. Only one is signed. One of them is missing.
Even though it's painted, and that would be
correct.
Classified as permanent?
It requires two signages, the one on the ground and the vertical sign, because we have snow.
Okay.
All right. We have a motion. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate File 851 be recommended to pass and
as amended
to the floor, I believe.
To the floor. Right. As amended.
As amended, yes.
Questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. You've seen the notes from Michael. We've got a lot of bills to get through in the coming days, so which we can do. Efficiency of debate. Thank you very much, members. We're adjourned.